Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Different Strokes for Different Folks, to find common ground and take it to the next level with David Clark here on Blog Talk Radio. Each week, the show will encourage you to keep an open mind and prepare to open the door to new understandings. We will have an exciting array of diverse guests who will point up the fact that we are all spiritual beings having a human experience. Now your host, David Clark.
Welcome to Different Strokes for Different Folks, where we will indeed be finding common ground and taking it to the max level. I'm your host, David Clark. I'm a spiritual adventurer, and I suggest you become the same. When you keep an open mind, you'll come to see that despite our seeming differences, we're all basically the same. You'll also see where you can find common ground so that you can relate rather than compare yourself to others. Now tonight, it's my pleasure to welcome Chad Meek. He grew up in the belly of the early UFO contact awareness movement during the early 60s at a place called Giant Rock, located in California's Mojave Desert. It is here at the age of four he had his first of many alien abduction and other experiences of the supersensible world. His unique pedigree within the UFO contact awareness movement was well established before he was born by his enigmatic Uncle George Van Tassel, who was the undisputed worldwide leader of all things in the UFO subculture during the time period from 1947 to 1975. While writing the original Giant Rock, the movie, a science fiction screenplay based on true events about his family and the people of Giant Rock era, he had an epiphany that the work would not be complete without the inclusion of his own UFO experiences. The critically acclaimed 266-page novel, Giant Rock, which was published by Tranglum Publishing and Amazon, is the combination of the original Giant Rock screenplay and the sequel. Mr. Meek is president and CEO of Clarity Resources Incorporated, as well as Giant Rock Universal, which is a 100% owned multimedia company that owns the intellectual copyright to the book Giant Rock, the greatest UFO story never told. The screenplay Giant Rock, the movie, as well as Giant Rock Experiences. Mr. Meek is a welcome guest and commentator on all things UFO related and has appeared on 240 radio and podcasts. So welcome, Chad. How are you tonight?
Oh, hey, I'm fantastic, David. It's my pleasure to be able to chat with you and your many listeners.
Well, it's great to have you here. As I mentioned to you, I have a lot of listeners that are interested in UFOs, and then, of course, there are a lot of skeptics out there. What do you want to tell the skeptics?
Well, you know, I don't mean to be this, flippant, and please don't get offended, but I'm not evangelical, I always tell people, I said, yeah, I've literally been in circumstances where, hey, I'm very skeptical of all this, and I say, you know, I said, that's good, because you're one experience away from being a believer, but until that time happens, then then essentially you're just going to have to trust me in my experience. So I kind of says, hey, listen, skeptics are very welcome. And incidentally, I'm skeptical also too. I mean, you know, every time somebody tells me something of the supersensible world, I'm always trying to figure out, okay, is there an angle here? What's going on? Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I do appreciate skeptics.
I hear you. What do you mean by supersensible world?
Well, actually, the supersensible world is essentially, if you can visualize this, I mean, for instance, I don't look in, like, I'm in an so-called empty room right now. Well, we know by physics and science and what have you that there is no such thing as an empty room, that there's all kinds of atoms, all kinds of things going on. And that includes spiritual people, spirits, has to do with all kinds of incarnate energy that goes on. And so I call this a supersensible world that's out there. And but yeah, there's no empty space out there. We're all one, and we're all together. And some of us are a little bit more adept at seeing it, and others are not so. But that's fine too.
Why do you think it is that certain people have UFO experiences and many do not, or many do not recall them?
Yeah, you know that's a great question. I really believe that the answer is one for the ages, and this is the best I can describe it. Is that according to Dr. John Mack, there's been well over between 1955 to 65, there are over 2 million actually abductions. And now he was a Harvard professor and also a Pulitzer Prize winner. So there's been some extensive research that says that it's a lot more common than people understand. But I actually think it has to do with the pineal gland, that channel or that third eye, for some reason, and for me, and especially if you've had early childhood experiences, that tendency that gland stays open, which actually that's our key to the supersensible world and that whole visualization. And usually, it's problematic because, we live in a 3D world. So when you're actually seeing things like spaceships and extraterrestrials and ghosts and things like that, aberrations, which I've seen them all, it can be problematic, especially as you're growing up in a three-dimensional world where that simply isn't appreciated. Now, in different time periods, like if we were living with the Mayans, the Aztecs, if you were having this experience, then you would be considered a shaman, and you would be put in a different class. Or back in Egypt, you'd be considered a priest. You'd join the priest class as far as that. Well, unfortunately, because of modern medicine and what have you, what the reward is when you start saying you have visions and things like that, modern day psychiatry and what have you, they have a tendency to medicate you. so it's not as appreciated.
Right.
But I try to explain to people, and this is there's a huge difference. What a lot of experience experience is a form of acute schizophrenia. Okay, it's literally they're of one world, but they're viewing another world. So they temporarily have an acute episode where they're able to see something that others don't. That's the best explanation as far as what it would be, I guess, trying medically as far as what is the experience. Now, that not to be confused with paranoid schizophrenia or any of the other things that can go on, but an acute schizophrenia experience, and then it goes away. Then they basically adapt back into the 3D world, and it ends. But the memory doesn't. The other thing too is the biggest factor is when your pineal gland is open, you have a tendency to remember, and they call this the fading splendor of years gone by. And they talk about this in the Atlantean time, the Lemurian time, where essentially just more of a spiritual, we were more of a spiritual entity until we actually kind of got this density as far as with this, incarnated in these mammal bodies. So that's a brief description as far as why it is and what have you. Incidentally, I mean, for most people, and I've interviewed so many, in fact, we actually did a pilot called The Real Truthers, and we were filming people who actually had direct experience with UFOs and with extraterrestrials and in some cases ghosts, and essentially they weren't welcome experiences. I mean, these things take a lot of understanding and a lot of openness to be able to perceive what's kind of going on with that whole thing. And again, just because you haven't had one doesn't mean another person you know, what they're feeling isn't, you know, very, very real to them. And you know, that's kind of what it is. So, yeah.
Well, what have the experiences been like for you?
Well, when I was actually the first one, the first clue was voices out of the sky. That was the one thing. And out in the desert, for some reason, I was kind of a very, you know, in the you know, out in the desert, there it's you know, especially where we're at, out in the middle of nowhere. We're talking about maybe at the time period, 50 people within about a 20 square mile or you know, area. There just wasn't a lot of activity, and there was no there wasn't you know, huge power lines and things like that. It was very, very remote. So I guess if so, it was a very open place, and so your imagination, of course, would go. Would go with the territory because, you know, for instance, we'd make a day of it just running up and down a gully and you know, experiencing the desert and what have you. But I started hearing voices, and it was kind of a question and answer period, which my uncle explained in one of his book, When Stars Looks Down. He talked about this idiophone where the actual extraterrestrials literally speak through this thing, and then they observe us. They call them, in biblical times, they call them the watchers, and you know, as far as these extraterrestrials, and they would actually transmit. So I would ask, like, I would actually ask a question kind of in a prayerful way, you know, if there is God, then call my name. Well, one episode that I had, which is actually in the book, I was on top of my grandmother's Airstream old beat-up trailer looking up in this, you know, cloud, and I asked this question. All of a sudden, I had this gigantic crackling noise that was almost like a trumpet come through my ears and yell my name, Chad. And, of course, you know, they always say, be careful what you pray for because you may just get it. And so whatever this entity or whatever it was kind of playing around with me, and it actually said, yes, you know, there is a God. And so what I did is I jumped, there were some scraps that my grandmother had in big boxes. I was a little kid. I jumped off the top of the trailer, and I ran inside of my grandmother's house, and I hid underneath underneath her bed because it was such an interesting experience. So that's kind of some of the stuff that was going on. And then at four, very shortly thereafter, I was literally teleported through a glass window out in the middle of the desert to an awaiting ship that was about 30 feet outside of my grandmother's house. And for some reason, I come from a very large family, and they had actually chosen me at that particular time, and they had brought me through teleported me through this window. They had placed me on this stainless steel, almost hospital type clinical thing, and they started doing experiments with me. And the texture, as far as what they're very, very short. These were the notorious grays. Which seems to be one of the, as far as the class of aliens, they're the ones that have done most of the abductions. And for some reason, they had picked me, and they started doing medical probes in various places in my body and things like that. And they were telepathically, they didn't speak telepathically. They kept on telling me that everything was going to be fine, that I wouldn't remember the experience, and which wasn't true. In fact, when I woke up the next day, some of the actual physical response that I had was I stuttered profusely. I couldn't speak a continual sentence, and that went on for quite some time. And I had a very high fever that required me to go to the doctor to because there was something wrong with me. And so yeah. So for me, it was. It was a very traumatic, and it's actually been seared in my psyche. And in fact, even whenever I speak about this stuff, which you know I've spoke about this at conventions and things like that, and of course on radio and television, my body temperature actually increases. Like my face right now is flush, and I because of the experience is something you don't forget. So, but that was my whole thing. And other than the texture of them, I could they had a distinct smell, and it, a musky, almost a musky smell that they had, and their texture of their skin was by far different. And they were very, very they were very short. They were like 3 feet tall, and there were four of them, and they kept on kind of moving around, and they had one particular instrument that they had stuck in my ears and my nose that had a small light into it. But that was my experience. Now, that was first of many. That was the most the one that I remember the most vividly. I'd had several other missing time periods where I was gone out in the middle of the desert for 6 to 8 hours where no one could find me. And I don't recall that. I've done some regression therapy where I've gotten to a certain point, but I don't remember them as vividly as the first one. However, I did have one where they were literally trying to – I was on a swing, and they were actually pulling me and telling me to let go of the swing, and I wouldn't do it. And this was when I got older, and I just said I'm not doing this. And literally, my hands were literally almost they were a little bloody, hanging onto the chain of the whole thing, and it literally went vertical. So for me, and this went on to about age 10. So the most of these things, and including my brothers and sisters had and cousin had had experiences also during that time period. One of which was my younger brother and sister were literally put in a refrigerator. There was and we don't know what that was about. And literally we found them almost dead. So there was a lot of very interesting things that were occurring out there, especially at Giant Rock. It seemed to be a vortex, and so hence, you know, as I got older, I thought, well, you know, I've told these stories to my children and to some, you know, people. My regular life, I was running oil and gas companies and doing mergers and acquisitions, investment bank. I was pretty much doing an international business with a focus on minerals. And so I never really got in, you know, I always had the stories, and I, of course, would talk to some of the old timers and the family members that were all out there, but I never really did anything with this. So, in fact, I was talking to a friend of mine living next to me on the beach, and he was an actor, and he was asking me about my childhood, and so I freely told him, he says, you ought to write a screenplay about this. So I did. That's kind of where we're at today on this thing.
Well, tell us about the screenplay and the book.
Well, the screenplay takes it. I mean, this is an epic period piece, and we go from 1930, both the book and the screenplay, we go from about 1930 to 1963, and we take everyone back into this eclectic time period, especially after – where the story begins is around 1930 by a man named Frank Kreitzer that actually had a vision about this giant freestanding rock out in the middle of nowhere out in the desert and said he needed to go there. And he'd kind of wandered into my uncle's gas station in Santa Monica, California, and they told him this. Well, one thing came to the other, it led to another. They actually had grub-staked him with food and actually fixed his old Exeter for free and sent him out there with the hope, his vision was that there was this great treasure that was to be found out there. And we call it we have a name for the treasure. It's called the Ugrata Cell, which is actually a combination, a mixture of various minerals that literally is a part of a rejuvenation process where literally people get immortality. But that's where the story kind of starts. But there was a man named Frank Kreitzer, and this actually happened. He was a German immigrant, and unfortunately, he was murdered inside of the rock. What he had done, he had carved out this rock out in the middle of nowhere. He was a follower of Dr. Rudolf Steiner and Nikola Tesla, very, 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 very intelligent guy. And he literally created a whole living space inside of a rock. out in the middle of the desert, and it was positioned perfect where in the summer, where the temperatures were extraordinarily high, it would be ambient down there, and it stayed pretty warm in the winter. So he had that, but he spoke broken English, and he was on a shortwave radio transmitting out there. And this is he had been living out there for about 11 years, and unfortunately, some of the authorities were suspicious. They went to go check him out. Well, one thing, you know, they had mining, they had blasting caps, and they had dynamite, and one thing led to another, and there was an accident that occurred, and he got eviscerated down there, and this has happened in 1941. So essentially, So he was down. So my uncle, had always kept in contact with him since 1930. So in 1947, right after the Roswell event that had occurred, my whole family, including my father and my aunt, and had actually moved out to the desert and out there and started living, and that's when a lot of the experiences were occurred, but. There were many that were occurring also with Mr. Kreitzer also, and for some reason he had a knack for to be able to communicate and channel with these extraterrestrials from afar. So, and he had taught some of these same techniques, which are actually being done today by, I've noticed, like Stephen Greer, he has the same channeling process that my uncle and Frank Kreitzer had done out there. So the legacy of Giant Rock, which essentially most people, some people know about. I've gone all over the world. People have known about my uncle George Van Tassel. Some people have not, but a good portion has. But part of the legacy is that everything that was a crossroads of all of ufology and what have you that occurred out there, because vis-a-vis my uncle, who was the leader of these large conventions where thousands of people would go out there from all over the world. So that was they were carrying the banner as far as for UFO disclosure back then, that, you know, trying to get the government to, release more information about, extraterrestrials and things like that. So that was going on, and so it's a very colorful story, as you kind of imagine, and it actually goes through multiple generations. It's not only it's my family, but also with Frank Kreitzer. He was the guy that had started, and even today, I actually have an associate producer. He's an experiencer. Him and his five friends from Hollywood had went out there, and that's how they contacted me. They had this experience out there, an incredible experience, and one of abduction. So it's kind of a hot spot as far as, and it still is today. So at any rate, that's kind of a little bit of a snapshot. But my uncle also, he was a regular on the Long John Neville show, which is, for those who you'd have to be almost maybe a little over 60 to know about the Long John Neville show, which Larry King took that show over. That was the precursor to Coast to Coast. That was before Coast to Coast. Well kind of like you. He has a bunch of interesting guests on with various this Long John Neville. He was very, very big back in the day out of New York. And so my uncle and Jackie Gleason and all the cast of characters – would talk about UFOs and with open minds and what have you. So you're doing a very similar show to what the Long John Neville was doing back in the day.
Huh. Well, tell me more about this channeling. I'm very interested in that. How the communication is established.
Well, it's they actually what it is, and it's almost it's the best the name channeling actually the story behind it is my uncle he had one of his big claim to fame is he was made the cover of Life magazine, and the reporter that was asking, well, how do you do it, he goes, well, it's almost like I use my brain as an instrument, and I literally, it's like turning a channel within using my. And how they would do it is they would go into incidentally, they used to hold weekly channeling sessions. They would go into a prayer, prayer, music, meditation, and they would hold their hands and they would focus on an entity, and they would actually out there. It was very quite simple. That's what they did, and they would receive transmission from extraterrestrials, and that was their technique. It's just that my uncle was a lot more, and Frank Kreitzer, they were very, very adept at it, and they were really gifted when it came to that. So when he was asked, what is this? Well, it's like you turn a channel, and I can, do this. But there have been some miraculous events that occurred with that, where they would literally bring in spaceships over this dry lake, by channeling, by literally focusing on these entities out there that would come up within their whole mind, and so they were very, very adept with it. But one of the things too, and I kind of laugh at it because it's the first I get asked this a lot, and I was on one show, and it was and the one guy says, well, how do you do it? And I had to say this. I said, well, you stand out in the desert and on one leg, and you sing out to the whole UFO world to come visit you. And then he asked me, he goes, well, what do you do if that doesn't work? I said, well, you switch legs.
Go ahead.
Yeah, well, it's really a deep form of meditation and being deeply relaxed and focused, and if you're in an area such as Giant Rock, which they have, it's one gigantic conductor too. And I don't know whether you got to look at this. First of all, if you go on the internet, you can see it. There's this rock. Is the equivalent of about 8.5 or 9 stories high. It's huge. So just the displacement as far as the energy. Plus, you're out in the middle of literally nowhere. It's more so back in the day, where literally there was activity going out there anyways. So that's essentially what they did. And the more and more that they became more and more adept at it, and it worked. So they literally channeled in spaceships, and all kinds of very interesting things happen too. My uncle, back in the day too, and even today, if you're an airline pilot, you're not encouraged. There's all kinds of sightings going on with commercial pilots and military pilots. It happens quite regularly. I mean, it's not something that is that they'd like to let you believe it's unique. So what they would do is they would have a hard time talking to anybody that was in the whole ufology part of it. And I remember as a little kid, I would see military planes, I'd see helicopters out. They had a restaurant out next to the rock, and I'd see these guys in military jumpsuits and things like that. Well, back in the day, everyone smoked cigarettes and they were drinking coffee out there and what have you. And I would always wonder, out there? Well, as it turns out, if you had a sighting, if you reported it, then you were generally summarily pushed off the side, or you would literally be under medical observance, if you claimed that you saw, So a lot of these guys would literally almost implode with this information, because if you, especially if you're an adult and you have your first thing, this challenges every, your Judeo-Christian world, your whole so-called normal world. And so my uncle was the X-factor counselor, explaining these people. And some of the research that my uncle had done, there was over 105 different species that had been visiting this Earth for forever. And so he was the guy to talk to. So it was really interesting. So visually, if you can think about too, and the film and the book is really done by a character I affectionately call Chase, which is it's a derivative kind of my name Chad. But if you can look it through my lenses, as far as that, you're seeing all this extraordinary stuff like As an example, 10 to 12,000 people show up on a weekend out in the middle of nowhere like I said, you might see 25 or 50 people in a given year. Or you see military helicopters, military planes at this dry lake landing out there. And everything always seemed kind of out of place. It just seemed so weird because I was always befuddled. I would always say, and no one could ever explain to me the whole, reason as far as on some of the what they were out there for as a little kid. So it's actually, this is written through my eyes and of course the film, once we get it shot, it'll be shot through my eyes, through my observation and my me being a direct witness, which incidentally, as the years go by, I'm becoming as far as people that actually lived out there, there's less and less people that have survived because, as an example, my uncle George, he died in 1978. A lot of the old timers, a lot of the people that were involved with the whole movement out there, they've since passed on. And just by luck, I'd stayed in circulation with them, and I got a lot of the stories firsthand, and were able to verify a lot of the events that had happened, out there through different sources. So not only did I get it from our own family, family stories, as far as that, I actually was able to get to the, like, for instance, Gabriel Green, a guy who actually ran for the U.S. Senate, was out there. But also, too, there are people like Howard Hughes. He was a regular that came out there of the, he was the aviator, billionaire. He was a regular.
Right.
My uncle had actually worked for him. My uncle had worked for him during the war years, in aviation, and he was a flight engineer for him, and so they became friends. And my uncle had created this thing called the Integraton, and which is a rejuvenation and a time travel machine, which actually is still out there, and the place is packed with people every day. We're no longer connected with that. That was sold many 25 years ago, but this building is still out there, along with the big, with giant rock within the very close proximity, and it's still going on right now. Well, Howard Hughes actually donated some of the money for the early development of this thing, and really what it is, it's this white dome that's sitting out in the middle of nowhere, there's no metal that's involved in this thing, and so people go out. And they take these sound baths. The acoustics are just, right now the big thing in the whole UFO and metaphysical is these acoustics, and it literally has this pure sound because of no metal interference. But even today, people seem to get medical benefit from really going in there and sitting inside of this rejuvenation machine. And the irony is that these things are still there. They're actually physically there, and which is kind of unique. And so it's a big part of the Giant Rock legacy and my uncle's also. So
interesting. Well, taking it a step farther, what kinds of contact have you had with other people that have been abducted? What kind of network, if any, have you established?
Well, it's hit and miss. One of the things with the real truthers and one of the problems is a lot of people don't want to come forth. The 2003 abduction where these they were in the movie industry and they would periodically go out to the rock and they would literally camp there. Well, as an example, one of the women that was actually abducted, and the people that were with them, which is actually an associate producer of mine, he saw her be abducted. He saw the spaceship land, and it really rocked their world. It rocked it so much that they all quit. They all got out of the movie industry. In fact, four of them literally went across the country and walked across, took a year off and walked across the country to get to know, Mother Earth, and their whole world changed. Well, I sat on with her for probably about 8 hours on the phone, And every time I wanted to get her on camera, you know, the date kept on getting pushed back further. And so what was happening with her is that she was not comfortable with it. But as far as network goes, it's very loose. I've done a lot of, I've learned some of the things as far as in hypnosis, and I have the ability to, take people back, and I've done that quite extensively. I have right now, I think I've done about 50, a little over 50, people where I've done, where I brought them back and got their stories firsthand and kind of helped them, reintegrate that within themselves and get that good handle. So yeah, I've done that. My avocation is, of course, a metaphysical counseling, and I'm, I'm an astrologer and psychic and things like that, so that kind of comes in handy. And it's all kind of one of the same as what I've done with, for me, trying to figure out the events that occurred. I kind of was on this dual track trying to figure out what was happening to me and why me and the whole thing. So you kind of get into this, really metaphysical or spiritual search to figure out, why, why me? And again, I come down this whole thing where literally, it had to have been me, and or why not me, as far as that. And the sheer numbers of people that are, that have claimed abduction and are coming out more and more and more as time goes on. So it's a little less. It used to be kind of essentially you were part of this freakish world, and now it's actually more acceptable to share your truth now, which is a good thing. And so I'm very excited and uplifted with that. The other thing too is the sheer numbers as far as people who don't believe in extraterrestrials, life on other planets, is dwindling. The numbers of believers are growing exponentially, and I'm very impressed with that. As far as the sheer numbers of people that are actually coming out and saying, "Hey, wait," it was around in the 70s. And in the 80s, it was around 40%. Now it's getting up in the mid-60s, and this is worldwide.
Really?
So, yeah. So, which only stands to reason. I mean, obviously, we're here. I mean, and now they're finding planets that are very conducive. They have water, and so there's multiple places. And there's a physicist called Dr. Drake, up the Drake formula that came out, and it's literally he had estimated that there were they're talking about hundreds of millions of galaxies that have supportive of life, and so consequently, it's to me, when I think about it, it's somewhat arrogant to think that we'd be, out of all these, twinkle, twinkle little stars out there, that we'd be the only one out here. And I think it's been one of the, it just doesn't make any sense. So,
Well, is there any correlation between people that have been abducted? I'm wondering if extraterrestrials are seeking similar types of people or different people or any insight onto that?
Yes. In fact, there was a guy, Kevin Smith, and I was on his show, and he had done, and this is not empirical of this, but he was working with some researchers about this, and there's for some reason, Native Americans have a by far more rate of abduction, and mixed blood with Celtic or with that. There seems to be an inordinate amount of people, and people with green eyes also have a tendency. There's more people with green eyes that get abducted too. So So I don't know what it means, as far as that goes. But there, it's interesting what he found, because, you know, it was like, okay, the whole Native American and Anglo mix seemed to be attracted to Native Americans more so than other study groups, and others, and also green eyes, which I thought that was strange, because I have green eyes. My mother was born on the Cherokee Indian territory in Oklahoma, as far as that, and I thought that was very interesting. So that was some of he said. So, I don't know. Children seem to be more likely to be abducted. I mean, granted, there's the Betty and Barney Hill thing up in up in Maine and New Hampshire, and we've seen this. Actually, I was on I was talking to one guy, and he goes, "Well, how come the black people never get abducted?" He says, "ZT prejudice," and I just kind of laughed at it, and I go, "Well, no, Barney Hill, that was they're actually an interracial couple that they were one of the first people that really came out and the standout as far as that stuff goes."
Remember.
So the answer is yeah. So it doesn't. I mean. Other than that, I mean, I have nothing empirical as far as, any kind of data as far as that goes. They seem to accumulate in families. I do know that, my cousin, and especially us out there in the middle of nowhere, my mother was extremely skeptical. So, as far as anything, and she wasn't a person you wanted to share anything with the UFO or my uncle's work or anything like that. Until me, my sister, my older sister, and her, we were all walking out at the desert, and we got buzzed by a low-flying UFO, and it was amazing. And from that point on, I never heard anything derogatory about my uncle or the whole UFO movement after she had her sighting. So that's when I tell people, I said, listen, don't. I mean. It's one of those things. I mean, and I have no, my experiences have been more random. Like, for instance, I'm down here in Mexico on the Pacific Ocean, and I've had six sightings since I've been down here for the last 5.5 years. So, and,
really?
And they're random. They're random. Amazingly, I'll be standing and I'll go, with my wife, and I said, do you see that? Do you see that in the sky? And she'll look at something else and say, oh yeah, is it Venus or something like that? No, it wasn't. I would see this thing screaming by. She couldn't see it, with the exception of one time. We had one that was coming directly. We have these large decks out there, and we had one traveling over the Pacific Ocean. It was going directly towards me. And she finally had saw it, and I was so relieved, because I think, oh, good, at least she got to witness this whole thing. But for some reason, I'm more inclined to receive them, and I don't know. I think it has to do with this, it's a term called cognitive dissonance. If it's out of your reality, then you tend to, and this is very similar to, when the Indians, when Columbus came, and landed, they couldn't really see their ships simply because they weren't used to seeing that. So you get this cognitive dissonance, and it's like, if it's not in your own reality, you're not gonna see it. And people mistake that, you're seeing things through your eyes. Well, that's really not where you're processing this stuff. You're processing through the centers of your brain, and in your eyelids, and eyes are a filter for it. Well, if your brain cannot conceptually conceive of this, then you're going to shut it out, and you're not going to see it. And that's been proven scientifically. So, for me, I think pineal gland was open. It stayed open. I've had extraordinary, psychic events. I've been pulled into missing people and missing bodies and things like that with various authorities down here. I had an event about 4 years ago where a person committed suicide, and I actually had found where he had jumped off and in the ocean and just had ended it all. But so I've had these extraordinary events from on a psychic level, and I think it's just because I've been trained to not, to pay attention and to listen to, I guess, the more subtle forces and the more refined messages that are out there, or information. So I think that's what I've done. But in the same breath, I mean, there have been certain gifts I've had very early on, but they've been intrusive. I mean, like, for instance, I didn't jump up and down and say, yeah, I was a UFO contactee in high school. I mean, here's my confession. I mean, of course, none of us have ever experimented with marijuana. I'm sitting around. And I wasn't back in the day either. I was just sitting around with my friends watching, of course. But I'm sitting around. My uncle comes on television. My uncle comes on television on this show, and I'm sitting around with my friends, and they're going, unbelievable! I can't believe this. This is so extraordinary. Well, we had moved more into Los Angeles County, and I'd kind of distanced myself, and I just sat there like a lump of coal, and I sat there and I said, "Oh yeah, it's interesting." Basically, I mean, I could have sat there and give them, but I just didn't do that. In fact, my cousin, there's some psychic damage that occurs too. That's one of the downsides. My cousin, he was having multiple events and multiple visitations, and he literally, we had moved into, like I said, away from the desert, and he had asked my mother if he could, live with us, because he didn't want, because he told my mother, that he was experiencing stuff and it was making him very uncomfortable. And so he did. He lived on our couch. And each time, I remember when I'd gotten past all that stuff and I was about 15 years old, my cousin would always want to talk to me about this stuff. And I just didn't want to talk. I just didn't want to talk to him about it. It wasn't something like, I was always trying to distance myself from that whole thing. But the irony about my uncle and his work is that I would go literally all over the world, and I would inadvertently run to somebody that had known him, and this goes from rocket scientists to to all kinds of different people. I've had several events where literally people have kind of fingered me for this whole event. For some reason, they had known that I was somehow connected to it, which seems extraordinary. One event, we were doing a joint venture out in the Nevada on some land satellites. It was for oil and exploration, and we were bringing in Morton Thiokol and some other people, trying to get them to joint venture with us. And this one guy, who was, I guess, a devotee of my uncle and a follower of him, had just literally from the and he was running that department. He, from the very start, he kept on probing me as far as where I was from, et cetera, et cetera. And I was not interested in going there because I was there on a different thing there. But as it came out, he found out that I was from Giant Rock. They actually lived out there, that George was my uncle. And he was just so intrigued with that literally the other side of the business thing that we're trying to do never got done. It all centered around this stuff. And I had this happen in Belgrade, Yugoslavia, Tokyo, where I'd inadvertently run into people that had a connection with Giant Rock. And that's why it's really important that, as far as the film goes, because this is really a crossroads. And literally, it wasn't just Howard Hughes. It was L. Ron Hubbard was out there, Jack Parsons. A lot of very crazy people were gravitated towards these events that were occurring out at Giant Rock. So it was kind of like the who's who and this crossroads of people. And, of course, Project Blue Book, all the spooks from the FBI, CIA, all the intelligence agencies were extremely interested in this, to the point where my uncle was put on the most dangerous persons list because
really?
They felt that him and his – oh, yeah. They thought that him and his movement were a direct threat to public and social conditions, and they literally labeled, you know, because it was growing, and more people were actually starting to listen to him about the whole UFO and extraterrestrial connection out there. And so they literally tried to discredit him on several. I mean, he gave him a lot of ammunition, you know, on some of the things that he was up to. He was a philanderer in his own right, but it makes sense. But so they exploited him to a lot of different degrees. But as we find out, especially during the 60s, he had good company, which, you know, Dr. King was on it. A lot of people were on this list that they thought were actually were creating some sort of social disorder. And in many respects, with the amount of numbers that they were, you know, getting out there as far as this was kind of a precursor to Woodstock. And, and some of the larger scale movements, which were also deemed as threats to the social order and what have you. And it just turned out that essentially the whole giant rock movement was squelched, as far as that. And my uncle did have a very very mysterious passing in 1978. We have no proof, but it was just the irony is that granted he was getting older, but they found him dead in a hotel room that he had no business being at, about 70 miles away from out at the Rock. We couldn't figure out what he was there, and so he died in 78. So we had and through the Freedom of Information Act, we actually know what they were doing as far as what the intelligence thought of him and what they thought he was up to. And it was soon after the 1952. This is one interesting thing too, and this actually happened. This is well verified. In 1952, in July 52, there was the big saucer flyover in Washington D.C., and this is about a three day to a week occurrence. But what had happened was during that time period they were starting to do above ground nitrogen, nuclear testing. And so literally in part of my uncle's channeling sessions that he had done, he had gotten this transmission that said, hey, listen, you need to tell the authorities to stop doing this because it is destroying, it's destroying your environment. It will kill you if you don't stop this. And so my uncle just shrieked at the whole, you know, proposition of him trying to talk to Harry Truman and the whole Department of Defense saying, hey, during the Cold War, that, yeah, we shouldn't do this, that it's not only destroying this, the Earth's atmosphere, but it's actually destroying parallel universes, which that was an avant-garde theory back then about parallel universes, which now today it's quite common for scientists to say it. So, but at any rate, he's actually arguing with this council, this governing body that's out there called the Council of Seven Lights, and he literally he had told them, I don't want to do this, and so they said, no, you've got to tell them, and what we'll do is, to verify this, we'll do a flyover, we'll send ships over Washington, D.C. Well, so what he did is he sent out telegrams to Life Magazine, International Herald Tribune, all the various media outlets, and the Department of Defense, Army, et cetera, et cetera. And literally, it happened. They did for about 3 days. They had scrambled jet fighters, and this is probably one of the more documented. And they literally sat there over Washington D.C. in July of 1952. Well, when the feds got wind of that, he became a person of interest to them because they couldn't figure out why these extraterrestrials would be talking to him as well. Because at the time, is what we've discovered is that they were actually have been talking to our government for quite some time. So this put him on he got the cover of Life magazine, and it was a really huge event. But at the same time, he was really chastised, and literally, phones were tapped and things like that. And this went on for years and years and years. So it's kind of a So, you know, again, I mean, when I think of, when I look at this stuff, I mean, I've kind of, although I feel somewhat like Pee Wee Herman, you know, as far as, you know, the big adventure where, you know, I've actually lived this life, and I was hearing these stories firsthand, and it was this colossal amount of energy and excitement. You know, it's funny, the story kind of died down, and I thought, you know, this is something that I really need to get out there, and especially on film, because most people, you know, watch movies and films, and I didn't want to do a documentary because, you know, generally it's, you know, again, I thought a lot of people should really, you know, see this movie, and just it, because of it's eclectic, and it's really the who's who, and this literally this crossroads of what, you know, of where we were at during the time period as far as that. So that's kind of one of the main reasons I thought, yeah, this would be good to do. So anyway, that's essentially the I guess the origin, the reason behind, you know, Giant Rock, the movie, and Giant Rock, the book.
Is that when you wrote the book and the movie, is that when you came forward about your experience for the first time?
I did. And really, and actually, you know, when I was writing the screenplay, I literally had a block because what I wanted to do was play it safe. I wanted to play this, you know, I thought, well, I'll do a story, you know, I'll do a film about my uncle and Frank Kreitzer, and I'll pretty much profile them as far as that stuff goes. And literally the story became somewhat, I mean, for some reason it just didn't move that well. And I literally had this, I absolutely had an epiphany where it was saying, listen, you know, you're a living witness to this thing here. And literally, and I was literally almost channeling, you know, a voice, my uncle's voice, which I've heard it off and on in so many obscure ways through the years. And he says, write it however you want. He says, then people will go to the internet and they'll go look at, you know, look at the whole story. But you know, be creative, be entertaining, get people to start thinking about, you know, extraterrestrials and our human our involvement with them. And so from that point on, I mean, the screenplay was, I mean, I was struggling for about a month and a half with it, and then all of a sudden, boom, it was done. It was amazing. And it was and I think too, I had my acquaintance at the time, he was an actor, and I wasn't really quite sure in retrospect, saying, oh, you ought to write a screenplay. And I thinking, well, that's what actors tell people to do, or that's what people in the movie know, oh, yeah, you ought to write a screenplay, thinking that most people don't do it. Well, I'd never written anything. I produced a show for the old Financial News Network called Oil Line. I did that. And I'd wrote a column, business column, for the H.M. Greenspan newspaper group. And I really never done any kind of any fiction or any kind of, you know, I guess writing, what have you. So I wasn't really confident as far as, you know, as far as, well, you know. So I sent him, you know, the early drafts of it. And literally, you know, I mean, he called me. I sent him the opening, and literally called me at 12:30 at night. And he goes, oh God, this is really good, you know. So I kind of got some confidence from an encouragement from him. And so I went ahead and continued and got it done. So, you know, and we've had some early interest from various groups, and for it's tough to make a deal, you know, as far as you know, whenever you have any kind of you know, property like this, it's not easy. You get, you know, there's a creative control issue as far as this, and I talked with Travis Walton, you know, of Fire in the Sky, and I'm not sure if any of you or your listeners remember that show, Fire in the Sky, about the loggers who in Arizona were literally abducted, and there was a show. I actually went to the premiere of that, and he goes, Chad, he says that story, he says it's half of what the story is. And he says, I don't know what happened. He says, so when you're dealing with these, you know, entertainment people, you've got to maintain some. They said their biggest mistake was they had no creative control at all, and they had no say once they had actually sold the story rights. It was sold, and And so they have lamented all these years that the real story never got done the way they would have liked it to have done. So I have been carrying it pretty close to the vest as far as that stuff goes. And of course, I'm not really, this is a legacy issue. And this has potential for about 3 movies with the book. I mean, literally, I mean, it literally looks like a trilogy with all the various things going. And of course, if it's successful, which I believe it will be, and I think it's a story that's near and dear to a lot of people's hearts, that I believe that it will do substantially well at the box office because it translates to languages. Science fiction is a different, genre because it translates well into foreign languages. And the whole genre, I mean, it's a visual, genre versus a comedy or something like that, where in China or Russia they wouldn't get, they just wouldn't understand it. But everyone understands science fiction, they understand UFOs, et cetera, et cetera. So this has an actual potential for an international release once it gets done. We originally budgeted, my original budget was $15 million, and then a group from Warner Brothers producers, they came in, they were kicking the tires, and they came up with about a $30 million budget that was, and they fell off the end of the earth on that. And I had a Chinese group from Shanghai. They said this thing should be budgeted for $45 million. They wanted to buy the screenplay outright. They gave me an offer, but they didn't want me involved with the movie. And so it's like I mean I'm a writer and I'm also a director, and I know what this thing's supposed to look like, and so there was no way I was going to happen. So I thanked them. But one thing I did ask one of the English speaking guys, he was a very interesting conversation. I go, why would you even be interested in this? He goes, well, UFO, they've had a lot of UFO experiences over in China. He says, but also, he says, it's also a Western Americana, which a light bulb went in my head as far as that. There are people, when it comes to the West especially, we had the cowboys and Indians and things like that, but there's always an interest of the Wild West, so to speak, and this is just the next chapter in the whole Wild West thing, only it involves instead of Native America.
Well,
it's aliens.
Sad. We've run out of time.
Oh my gosh!
Yeah, I thank you for joining me, and I wish you well with your venture.
Hey, thank you. It's been my pleasure chatting with you and sharing the story, which we call Giant Rock, the movie. It's the greatest UFO story never told, and we look forward to getting out and sharing it.
Do you have a website, Chad?
We do, www.giantrockthemovie.com, and of course I'm on Facebook. And if there's anyone who wants to get a hold of me out there, my email is chad@giantrockthemovie.com, and we have about 60 pages of Google, so you can get in touch with me if you need to. So I'm always interested in chatting with people, either with experiences or, in fact, if they have any interest in maybe participating in the movie also. So, at any rate, so you can get a hold of me. So, okay. But, hey, listen, I thank you so much for having me on your show. It's been a pleasure.
You're welcome.
And I hope to give you some news fairly soon about when we actually will do principal shooting on this thing.
Sounds good. Okay. All the best.
All right. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Oh, okay. Goodbye. So once again, we come to a close. Now we can pause and reflect upon the idea that we are all united through the diverse tapestry of our individual gifts. There is no real thing as separation except in our own minds. We are each unique expressions of the ultimate source of our beings. We are spiritual beings having a human experience who can and will have a spiritual experience when we let it be. Have a great week, and remember, whatever you dream, you can realize. Good night, and God bless.